Hello, and welcome to Robbinsdale Revisited. In the 1930s, the federal government stepped up to improve Robbinsdale's infrastructure. The Works Progress Administration built Highway 100, or Lilac Way, plus installed wells for water and the local sewer system. The Public Works Administration built the senior high school. Also, gas lines were installed and coal was phased out. Another big change happened when Captain Billy moved his publishing business to Minneapolis. A few years later, Fawcett Publishing would move again to New York. Now, president of the Robbinsdale Historical Society, Pete Ritchie, will tell us more about the 1930s. Pete, would you like to share about the 1930s?
So yeah, it's the Depression decade, and of course, like everywhere else in the country, you know, you had the stock market crash, and the Great Depression begins. It doesn't happen like a light switch, in 1929, Robbinsdale is actually suffering from another blow sort of to its history and its family, as in the late 1920s and 28 and 29. We lose Amy Robbins Ware, who at the time was playing a prominent role locally with the real estate business that her father started. And we lose Adelaide Walker Robbins. And she was a Civil War nurse. She was the wife of Andrew B. Robbins and the sister of T.B. Walker, who the Walker Art Center is named for and who played such a big role in getting the library started in Minneapolis and played a big role in Robbinsdale because he bankrolled things like Andrew B. Robbins' factory endeavors, his streetcar, and just whenever the Robbins family needed a couple dollars, they could turn to their uncle TB for a little extra. So we get into the 1930s, and Edith Robbins is still playing a prominent role locally as far as the Robbins family. She's been on the school board now for 10 years, and whenever they're looking for federal funds, Edith Robbins, and her name was Edith Robbins Daniel at that point. Although she got divorced from her husband, but she is still carrying that last name. But she was very good at using her connections to get federal funds secured for Robbinsdale. And the other big role that sort of changes in the city is, although there's things like as we go into the decade, we have things like the WPA and the PWA and Highway 100 is being built. There's 4,000 men out there working on that through the WPA project. And Carl Grazier is a German immigrant who has been charged with building this giant highway. And along the way, he's planned these little landscaping scenic restway stops and picnic areas. And there's 7 of them dotting Golden Valley, St. Louis Park, and Robbinsdale, of course, is the biggest one called Grazier Park. So all that is just getting going in the 1930s. And then the federal government is also funding things like we finally get a high school in the 1930s. So as the decade opens, we're at about 4,500 souls in Robbinsdale. And, of course, the decade's mostly remembered for the Depression. As we go down Main Street, we've got the Village Hall is still there. We've got the Fawcett Publishing. Now in 1930, they're about to pack up and go to Minneapolis. Captain Billy Fawcett does leave the post office in Robbinsdale. He has all of his mail go through that just to kind of keep them busy and in business. So that's helpful. And at that time, Howard Lumber is providing coal and building materials. Robbinsdale's still growing just a little bit. There's still houses being built. But the VFW and the American Legion both step in and start playing a large role. Robbinsdale has all these veterans from World War I. The veterans also have got Victory Memorial Drive is built. And the veterans are just playing a bigger role in civic affairs. On Main Street, we got the Robbinsdale Grocery. William Mueller has opened up his drugstore and his movie theater, and the movie business is great in the 1930s. People are going to the movies. It doesn't cost much. And in this case of this little 300-seat theater, it probably cost even less because the snack bar was just over there in the drugstore, and drugstore at a fountain. There's a shoe store opens up next to City Hall, and that's there for many years. And we've got a couple little cafes downtown. We also have this thing called the Robbinsdale Rock Garden, which is a ballroom that got a fair amount of attention. And if we look at old ads for the time, we see there was Hattie and her Harlem Nighthawks came to town. The Robbinsdale Rock Garden gets a fair amount of attention. And, you know, the advertisements at the time make it sound like it was this wonderful place. And, of course, it burns down in the middle of the decade. So we don't get to see much more of it.
Pete, was it pretty agricultural still? And was there like a farmer's market here?
You know, it was still agricultural to the extent that there were potato farmers were just north of town, and everything got hauled through Robbinsdale. It generally went to the farmers markets down in Minneapolis. And that also reminds me, at this time, you've got all this agricultural goods and everything coming down from the railroad and along what's now Botno Boulevard going down to the farmers markets. And in the middle of the 1930s, we get the truckers' strike. And of course, there's not a lot in common with Robbinsdale there, except that we had a lot of people that were working in the warehouse district. And of course, these were the folks that were in unions. And there was a more extreme group of Trotskyites, which still makes me sort of scratch my head that Trotsky actually had any influence in Minneapolis, but that's what these folks called themselves. And of course, he was living in Mexico at the time, probably dating Frida Kahlo. At this time, Sacred Heart Church had a priest named Blum, and he was there until about 1930. In the early 30s, Father Nolan takes over. And the connection there is that Father Nolan, one of the riots that were happening down there in the warehouse district during the truckers' strike, a couple policemen were killed. A fair amount of Eunice also suffered, and there were people killed on both sides. It was horrible. But Father Nolan spoke at the funeral of the policeman, and this is a guy who generally avoided all sorts of publicity. I mean, I've scoured the newspapers trying to find things about him, and just even finding pictures of him isn't that easy. But everybody has a Father Nolan story. Now, he didn't die until the 1960s, and so he's a priest at Sacred Heart. And you just have to ask anybody who was alive at that time, and, you know, through the 50s, ask them about Father Nolan, and the stories just come out. One of my very favorite stories is there was Howard Holmes had a Chevrolet dealer right there on the main street next to the blacksmith. And of course, Christensen was our blacksmith. He was still in business at that time. And his daughter would pump gas, and the daughter would wear coveralls. Father Nolan would pull up to the sidewalk, and all these gas pumps were located right on the sidewalk. So you'd drive down Main Street, and you had a couple of places where you could pull over and fill up with gas. And she would come out and fill his tank up, and he was outraged that she was in these coveralls, these gas pumping coveralls. It's like, you know, and of course she wasn't Catholic, didn't go to his church, and didn't care. But the story is that he would pull up every time and scold her for being in coveralls and saying a woman, you know, needs to be in a dress. This is unwomanly, and, you know, you're a disgrace, etc., as she was filling up his gas tank. And so one day, of course, Father Nolan was very traditional and wore a Cossack. So one day, as she's filling up the gas and he's scolding her, he says, yeah, you know, maybe I shouldn't be wearing coveralls, but why are you wearing a dress? And that's an example of the sort of character he was. He was, you know, the one that would go out to the school, the playground at Sacred Heart, and bring out a ruler and make sure that everybody's dresses were long enough. As the 1930s go on, Robbinsdale actually screws up, and, you know, here we are, prohibition's is being lifted, and the politicians, you know, forget to sign the paperwork, and they make it an error in the date, and prohibition doesn't get lifted in Robbinsdale until a year after it does everywhere else. But then the saloons start opening, and Adolph Julie is the first one one of the first ones to get a license. Then you had Mint's Canteen just down the way. And there was another place called Bill's Bar. So we had saloons again after, 10 years of prohibition. And the Julie family was influential. The Flo Julie had a little clothing business right there on the main drag too. And apparently when they went to church one day and after they would open up their saloon, Father Nolan just started scolding them in front of the congregation. And of course, they had given a lot of money to Sacred Heart. Their business was doing well. They thought they were good Catholics, but he decided to call them out in church for owning a saloon. And they never went back to church and they never gave any more money to Sacred Heart. And Father Nolan was a huge railroad enthusiast. And as time goes on, he starts learning how to film things, and he filmed the trains coming through Robbinsdale. So, and in 1950, he starts using color film, and we have these old color films of him riding the streetcars through Minneapolis. He was a huge streetcar enthusiast. And eventually, he gets a streetcar as they're decommissioning them and brings it to the playground in Sacred Heart and films all the kids climbing up onto the streetcar and leaves it on the playground. But it was just that one day. Apparently, nobody was ever allowed to play on the streetcar or go in it again. He put it up on cement blocks and it sat in the playground for 10, 15 years. I know that it eventually went out to New Hope and sat behind the Cremet facility there off of 42nd, close to 42nd and Boone. But we don't know what happened to the streetcar after that. So Father Nolan just will keep appearing in our stories because he was that wild and that strange. And, the other thing he would do was just constantly be scolding women for the way they dressed as they walked down the street, whether they, belonged to his church or not. So he's remembered as a character that way. Of course, during the 1930s, again, Robbinsdale keeps the issue of annexation keeps coming up. So we still don't have a water system. And in 1932, Mayor Olgum, who was a huge champion of the annexation efforts, he actually has to resign in disgrace because he's embezzled a whole bunch of money from his own real estate business. And he actually ends up going to Stillwater Prison. That doesn't stop Robbinsdale from re-electing him again in the 40s, but we'll get back to that. But in 1932, we have another vote on annexation. Again, we get a majority of people want to be annexed to Minneapolis, but not a big enough majority. We still don't have 2/3. So that doesn't go anywhere. The other thing that happens in the 1930s, and it's hard to explain how this could possibly happen, but at some point, it's decided that there could possibly be gold in the hills around Crystal Lake, the little hills where Lakeview Terrace Park is. And, this just makes me scratch my head over and over again that anybody would ever possibly believe this. Just north of Crystal Lake, where Botano Boulevard runs up that hill, somebody buries a whole bunch of fool's gold that they had got in South Dakota somewhere. And they make a big show of it, and then they say they're out there digging, and they found all this gold. And so, 30, 40 people show up with shovels, and they're out there digging for gold. And, the idea that that could happen today, that somebody would just believe that there's going to be gold in the hill up there, just boggles my mind. But this made headlines over and over again during that decade. So Robbinsdale has always been well known for its schools. Just pioneering art programs, academic excellence, sports. The Robbinsdale High School still holds more trophies and honors than any other school in Minnesota because it was just such a powerhouse. It was the fourth largest school district in Minnesota, and we just had such an emphasis on sports. People like John Grigelko, people like Red Sox hockey, coached there for years and years. And of course, this all begins in the 1930s when E.J. Cooper comes to town. So E.J. Cooper had been he was a World War I veteran. He was a flyer and he trained and he was going to go over there. And when he lands in France and he's ready to climb into, you know, his airplane and go take on the Red Baron or whoever else Germany's going to throw at him. Anyway, the story goes, E.J. Cooper arrives in France and the Germans surrender because they knew he was coming. So he doesn't actually see battle. So he comes back to the United States and him and his wife pack up and they go down to New Mexico and they are school teachers there for a little while. They're from Iowa. And eventually they come to Minnesota because he's being recruited, just like superintendents are recruited today, to become the superintendent of the Robbinsdale School District. Now, at this time, the Robbinsdale School District is not, well, it's large, but not large in terms of people. It stretches all the way out there to practically to Corcoran, you know, through Plymouth, and then back all the way to Robbinsdale. And we just have the one school building, although it's been expanded lots of times. The old Parker School, they just keep adding wings onto it, but we still don't have a high school. As I mentioned before, Edith Robbins Daniel is on the school board, and between her and Cooper, they start courting the federal government for some money. And eventually, they get a grant of $100,000, and they and this is the Public Works Administration, and construction starts on the new school. So it was really exciting for us to have a high school, and E.J. Cooper starts, it's just the beginning of his expansion. If we think of how many schools the Robbinsdale School District added as we go up into the 1960s. But this complex that was along Regent Avenue just keeps growing and getting bigger and bigger. So you got more additions to the Parker School. You have the high school being built. And not only is this used for schools, but the American Legion starts meeting there. The VFW is meeting there. All sorts of civic events are held in the school. And E.J. Cooper just has his office, and the district office is down at the end. And, you know, we don't think of superintendents now the way we did. When I look through the old high school yearbooks, E.J. Cooper is always right there, featured in every yearbook. At the beginning of the yearbook, it says, here's Superintendent E.J. Cooper, and there'll be a picture of him at his desk. But the new high school has all the bells and whistles. It has a PA system. And so the newspapers show E.J. Cooper demonstrating the PA system to everybody. But not only does it have a PA system, he can call every classroom from his office. He can call up and see what's going on in the classroom. And if he wants to, he can listen to what's happening in these classrooms. And so he's demonstrating all this. And it's the high school, architecturally, it reminds me so much of what we see in the old Archie comic books. You've got the soda fountain just down the street with the movie theater, and it seems like we're Riverdale instead of Robbinsdale, and that's the way that high school looks. But the high school is just the center of every sort of, you know, local activity, and it just swells us with pride. We have the Robbins, and we have the football team, and we can, you know, the town packs the football games, and the homecoming parades go down the main street. And most of the students prior were going to North High School, and just to have our own high school rather than send everybody over to Minneapolis, you know, just helps us become a real city or a real town. With this giant school district and this ambitious superintendent who's finally getting things done. I mean, the town had dreamed of having a high school for many years. And at some point, Robbinsdale decides that it would be better to be a city than be a village. And part of that is just to get some grants to get the water tower built and to get the water system in place. And so the water tower starts getting built in 36, 37. By 38, it's time to celebrate not only the water tower, but we've got a charter and we're going to become a city. And this becomes a really big deal. They make a day of it. They have a ceremonial burial of the old village, and all of the programs look like a funeral program where they're burying Robbinsdale. And just to show that we are a new city and how exciting it is to be a new city, we install kids for a day in the position of alderman and mayor And Adolf Julie's son plays the mayor, and he's 3 years old. And they set all these kids up that are, you know, between 3 and 5 years old, and they have a mock meeting and, you know, pass a couple ordinances, and they just make a big deal of it. So Robbinsdale is finally a city. We've really arrived now. We put on our big boy pants, and the old village hall is still standing, and that's where all the business is conducted. And we also begin with our summer civic celebration, and it's originally called Goodwill Days. And so we got a big parade going down the main street, and the crowds line it. And of course, it's a fundraiser not only for the fire department, but also to celebrate the water tower, because what the fire department needed more than anything was water pressure. And maybe now they'll be able to save some of those buildings that keep burning down along Main Street and the lumber yard. And Goodwill Days continues until the 1940s, when it becomes Whiz Bang Days. And so we've got our high school, we've got a thriving business district, we've got houses are still being built, but the Depression has taken its toll. And although the WPA is stepping in, and this is sort of analogous to what I think of when COVID happened, there were a whole bunch of government programs available and people were lining up to take advantage of them. And with the WPA in Robbinsdale, unfortunately, there was, you know, lots of pointing at fingers and saying, you're funding this, but you're not funding that. And these people need relief, but you're not giving it to them. And there was accusations of embezzlement again, and that the WPA was corrupt. So they changed out the commissioner a couple different times here, and mostly got that sorted out. The other thing is all of our civic organizations started playing a bigger role, whether it was the Girl Scouts. Again, the American Legion would just have these days where they would put men to work. They would go around and collect donations, and then they would actually pay these guys, you know, $5 for a day, which to go out and plant trees, to clean up parks, to, you know, pick up trash along the highways. And of course, another big activity of the Legion was to go along the railroad tracks and yank up all the marijuana that was growing there, because this could be a problem. Was it Reefer Madness? You know, the movie had come out, and the American Legion really wanted to play a role. They didn't want this stuff out there for the youth to smoke. And we have all these pictures of them standing in front of these giant piles of marijuana as it burns. And, you know, some of the names are familiar. You've got Walter Sipe out there, who owned the gas station, and he provides a great big truck. Another thing that sort of to whip up civic pride, and you would have these scrap metal collector times and newspaper drives where you'd bring newspapers and scrap metal over to the school, and the Legion would sort through it and decide what they could get, and then that money would go back into the Legion's programs. They were also doing a baseball team. They were supporting Boy Scouts, and of course the Girl Scouts were playing a big role in town. And we've got the high school now, and we got that great big school complex on Regent. And then we have one other little school that starts up, and it's called the Southtown Portable. And it looks like just a wooden building, one-room schoolhouse, maybe ever so slightly fancier. And it moves from time to time. So it starts out on Regent, and then it goes to about where Lee School was built later on 36th and Lee Avenue. And that's E.J. Cooper's, you know, first, you know, he knows that the district's going to grow, even though it's during the Depression. And that's the first school that's built outside of that Regent thing. And it will be the first of many to come. All right, so I'm just going to take us on a little journey back to Robbinsdale in the 1930s now. So, like, let's just say we're flying in, because the airport is still open. At this time, a guy named Shank, who eventually becomes a pilot for Northwest Airlines and sadly dies just a couple years later in a crash. But he's running a flying service out of the Robbinsdale Airport. And there's also flying lessons are available through Shank's flying service. And, you know, there's two or three planes that are leaving there every day. Walter Bullock is still flying out of the airport there. And, of course, he also becomes a pilot for Northwest airlines later on. And Captain Billy is probably still using the airport to get back and forth to Breezy Point. You know, commercial air travel is still a long ways away. There's at least one story in the newspaper where Shank takes up an 84-year-old resident of Robbinsdale just to show her what it looks like, what the world looks like from up high. And for some reason, she's just not all that impressed. But, you know, makes the papers because she's flying up. There's a guy named Don Vogue who is running some barnstorming exhibitions still in the 1930s where they're doing things like, you know, flying a plane through a barn. And destroying the barn in the process. Just all these amazing things that planes can do. But nobody's, you know, other than Captain Billy is hiring them to take them anywhere. But as you fly over Robbinsdale down there in McNair Manor, you know, they laid out the streets, but it just never filled in. So you've got, you know, all these streets where eventually there's going to be hundreds and hundreds of homes. But, you know, when 1930 opens up, you've only got maybe 15 or 20 houses down there. The other part of the city that is a little underdeveloped at that point is over there along Victor Memorial Drive. That's still a lot of open land. And as you go north to where Sanborn Park is now, most of that hasn't filled in. There may be 20 houses over there. Where it did fill in was over where the Stillman Farm was. So the western part of Robbinsdale, as you go west from the high school, you've got a neighborhood with, you know, a couple hundred homes that were built in the 1920s. And then as you go south from there, as you head toward where Hy-Vee is today and where the Terrace Theater once was, some of that is filled in, but there's still some empty land to the south. So pretty much the south, the north, the east are still, you've got streets laid, but you've got a lot of empty lots. And then as you come down at the airport and you head south toward downtown, you've got that row of houses where the Robbins Tea House is and where the Robbins Sisters got maybe 15, 20 homes built there along what's now West Broadway. And you have the Trump family house, and they still own a hardware store down there on the main drag. And then you kind of come into downtown Robbinsdale, and you've got a gas station on either side of you. And you've got the Hennessy Lumberyard and the Howard Lumberyard to the west. To the east, you've got the Congregational Church is there and the thriving institution. And as you come down into the main street, you've got a couple restaurants, another hardware store. You've got two car dealerships and at one time three. And then you've got the City Hall and Captain Billy's building is still there. You got the bank on the first floor and Fawcett Publishing on the next two floors up. Sacred Heart School, which was built in 1927, is thriving. And as we come back up along Hubbard Avenue there, of course, we have streetcars running down West Broadway. The old streetcar tracks are still in Hubbard. Nobody's covered them up yet. And as we come around the corner where we see the backside of Howard Lumber, we might see they still had a lumber wagon with a couple horses. It's odd to think that, you know, even in the 1930s, you were still using horses for if you were going to haul a bunch of lumber out to your place, if you were building something. The milkman, in some cases, was still coming in on horses. We know that we had at least four different dairies that were operating in Robbinsdale. The Ewalds came up from Golden Valley. You had something called the Johnson Brothers Dairy right there on West Broadway and 42nd. They didn't last long, and then they eventually became the Purity Dairy. You had a couple Minneapolis operations were busy up here too. And most of them were still using horse-drawn carriages at that point. So the milkman was going to come in and bring you your milk that way. But as you come around, go up Hubbard toward 42nd, we're probably going to run into Einar Dahl, who was our local artist and, you know, person of fame. But in the 1930s, he would take his easel around town, and you can almost follow his path through these old watercolors and paintings he did, and paintings of the Village Hall, and that hung here in the library for many, many years. He did paintings of the backside of Howard Lumber, of the little businesses downtown, of the library. And then he worked his way west around Crystal Lake and the little houses up around Twin Lake, and they all look pastoral and beautiful. They remind me of the children's book illustrations of people like Virginia Burton, Mike Mulligan's Steam Shovel, or Lloyd Bellman's Madeline. You know, they're a little bit whimsical. The perspective looks a little goofy. Of course, I think, you know, this was just his style. And Einar Dahl was, you know, just played the role of artist to a T. He wore a beret. His when he smoked a cigarette, you know, he had a long cigarette holder and spent his life doing this as a painter. Some of his works are, you can find them in the Art Institute in Minneapolis. You can find them in the Wiseman Museum. And of course, we have a collection here at the Robbinsdale Historical Society.
Thanks for listening. I'm Crystal Boyd. Robbinsdale Revisited is brought to you by the Robbinsdale Historical Society. Our little history museum is located at 4915 42nd Avenue North in the heart of Robbinsdale. We're open Fridays and Saturdays from 10 to 3. You can also visit us online at robbinsdale.org. You found this episode, so you know where to find the next one.
Bicycle into the city every Saturday to see our friends. Back home, sitting hand in hand, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, when the evening ends, in Robbinsdale, in Robbinsdale.
Our theme music is provided by Gabe Barnett and Them Rounders.